You do have a lot of charities, NGOs that basically exist to lobby for leftism and anti-racism, and the government provides a lot of their funding, and then they lobby the government to enact change. And these groups already represent anyone. It's like five Antifa with college degrees working in an office in Dublin somewhere, and 60% of their funding is from the government. So, you know, it's a strange system where the government is like creating its own think tanks, its own pressure and lobby groups, and lobbying itself to pass legislation that it wants anyway. And then there's like, you know, tens of thousands of people that are just employed on the public purse to do this.
Well, this is fascinating, Keith. So really, from the way you're articulating it, I hadn't quite thought about this before. The left come into government, mm-hmm. the left outsource their power mm-hmm. to what are, in a sense, constitutionally leftist extra-governmental organizations, mm-hmm. And then they make decisions. And so it's a way of ensuring leftist hegemony forever.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I am in Ljubljana, the beautiful capital of Slovenia, and I'm by the river Ljubljanica, and I am with my good friend, Mr. Keith Woods. Keith, hello.
How are you doing?
Good to see you. Good to see you. Good to see you, IRL.
Yeah. The sin never meets your heroes, but I'm pleasantly surprised. I can report that you're just as autistic in real life.
Ah.
That was very satisfying for me.
I can report that he's just as Irish in real life. And also really tall. About 6'4 or something. Extraordinary. So, Keith, what are your thoughts on the old Ljubljana?
It's very nice, yeah. It's my first time in Slovenia. I've been a few other places in the Balkans. This feels a lot more Western. I know they always considered themselves a bit more Western. You know, they were first out of Yugoslavia. It was kind of a very bloodless ordeal. So they're a pretty good advertisement for the old petty nationalism, I suppose. I mean, it's still very homogeneous here. I think it's 90% plus Slovenians. Functioning, advanced Western economy. It's a very beautiful place.
There's a bit of evidence of stuff creeping in, though, isn't there? I've seen a few delivery riders and things like that.
Yeah, there's a few delivery drivers, Uber drivers, but, we are in the capital as well. I don't think you'd see any of that outside of here, really.
No, well, what is it, do you think, that makes this so, it's so picturesque, it's so chocolate box. It's like, kind of like an Eastern European Amsterdam, but without the crime.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it is probably the homogeneity, isn't it? I just think this would be a bit different if there was a few hundred thousand Damalians living here.
Yeah, it's a great advertisement for white homogeneous societies. I think the size probably helps a lot. It's only 2 million people. That helps a lot for social cohesion. I think it makes people value the things that hold together a society a lot more. Some people have done studies on this. There's actually an interesting study you should look at. It's by a group of Harvard economists led by a guy called Glaser. And it was looking at why has the US never had a welfare state like Europe did, because that was pretty much a universal thing after the Second World War, right? All these countries moving to kind of social democracy models. And it's kind of interesting from our perspective because they put half the reason down to the size of the US that made it practically unworkable for various reasons. But they actually put the other half down to how racially and ethnically heterogeneous the US is. That basically a big factor is you can't get something like universal healthcare because people don't want to pay for the healthcare of other races.
Yeah.
So kind of interesting to see that in like a mainstream economist paper, you know.
Well, it fits with E Pluribus Unum, as Robert Putnam, doesn't it? If you get multiculturalism, social goods go.
Mm-hmm.
Social trust goes.
Mm-hmm.
And social trust goes both between the groups, of course, mm-hmm. but also within them.
Mm.
So they stop trusting each other. So yeah, I suppose that's
There's a lot of research since Putnam as well. There's actually a study I mentioned a lot. I think it was in 2020 in University of Copenhagen. They did a meta-analysis of every sociological study that's been done on the relationship between diversity and social trust. There's something like 93 studies, and like overwhelmingly, they found very strong relationship. Essentially, the more diversity you have, language, ethnic, racial, anything, the more social capital declines. So that's just like a well-established fact of sociology now.
Yeah, it's and Ireland, of course, where you're from, was until quite recently highly homogenous, highly Catholic, highly everything, and it's changed a bit. We start off. So you're originally from, for those that aren't familiar with Keith, you're originally from where in the country?
Yeah, I'm from the west of Ireland, rural part of Ireland called Roscommon, although it has produced E. Michael Jones. I think he traced his grandparents to the same village as I do, and I think Stephen Molyneux was born there. John Waters, maybe familiar with. So we've not got a lot of cultural achievements on the global stage. We've got a lot of like niche far-right isolates, I suppose.
Okay, there's some sort of evolutionary dynamic of the area which helps to produce far-right isolates.
Yeah, apparently so.
Okay, so then you went to, where did you go to university?
In Galway.
The UCG, Galway.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you studied what?
I studied philosophy, sociology, and politics.
But he didn't go to any lectures. Because I know two people that work there in those departments, and he doesn't know who they are.
I couldn't really name my lecturers, to be honest.
No. So how did you become, as it were, it's a question that we had a lot at this conference that we're at. It's kind of like when you're a kind of fundamentalist Christian church, you meet someone for the first time, and they say, well, how did you become Christian? So how did you become, as it were, based?
Well, it was through that process. I was kind of self-educated, and I was just drawn to ideas that were a bit different, a bit radical. I mean, I remember I started reading people like Roger Scruton, and I found these people like Peter Hitchens such a curiosity. And, you know, I thought they were completely wrong, but it was just curious to me that, you know, in current years, someone could hold these kind of like traditional conservative Burkean beliefs. I discovered people that were talking about race and never heard that before. So that was interesting to me as well. So, I mean, I always had an open mind for these things. I never remember, even when I was more on the left, reading any of those people. And, you know, this guy is a terrible racist or whatever. I remember I read Pat Buchanan's Death of the West. And I thought it would all be about culture and modern art or whatever. And it's all demographics. And I'd never even really considered, you know, that. You look at how to plan a society, you look at the future, and you consider things like birth rates and birth rates of races. But I was never horrified by any of it. You know, you read the arguments, they make sense. So it was kind of a quick process where I onboarded that. So,
And then you set up a channel, or what did you do?
Yeah, I had a couple of, you know, the wild, wild west days of the internet. I had a few, like, meme pages. I was doing it all anonymously. But I made a YouTube channel in 2019. That was kind of more going to be philosophy focused in the beginning, but probably became more political with time.
Yes, yes, and then we of course met on a show we won't mention, with a person we won't mention. I mean, one of the things that we read about a lot in the UK is, I mean, I know the UK is collapsing into multicultural hell, but it's almost as though Ireland has decided. And made a conscious choice to turbocharge this process and just kill itself. Yeah. Just go from being this wonderful place with a lot of crack and so forth to just be literally the Sinn Féin party is absolutely pro-multiculturalism and couldn't give a damn about the Irish people. Why do you think this Catholic country, this country that often is seen as back, was, I would say, 20 years ago, you know, I was there in 2002, you literally heard a little boy say, are we going to go to Mass tonight, Mark? Of course, we've got a Mass tonight. You know, they go every night. It's just what they do. So what's happened now? How is this taking place?
Yeah. It's not a Catholic country anymore. I mean, nominally, maybe on the census, you'll still get 80% of people saying they're Catholic.
Well, that's another thing, because you go back 25 years, it was a Catholic country.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As recently as 1983 or 4, was it? They had a referendum on making abortion being banned part of the Constitution of the Republic of Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, even in the 90s, I think it was moving towards a much more secular country. But yeah, the change happened quite fast. I mean, it's secular in the sense that there are still a lot of Catholics. There's still a lot of people that go to Mass, much fewer than before. But it doesn't enter into their lives in terms of, you know, what kind of political decisions they make, how they view the world, how they feel about these things. I mean, people will criticize the secularization thesis in sociology. But it's really not about the decline of religion as such. You know, I know you've done a lot of interesting work about how you'll have these faith-based communities rising because of birth rates and so on. Well, it's much more about the fact that religion just doesn't enter into the public square in terms of how you decide on moral issues. And it's been like that in Ireland for a long time. But yeah, the immigration levels, I mean, we import about 150,000 people a year now, which you break that down to per capita terms, we're increasing the population by 3% a year to mass immigration. And although Sinn Féin are very much behind the mass immigration agenda, I mean, Ireland is strange in the sense that we never really had ideological politics. You know, there was never an equivalent of the Tories. There's a Labour Party, but they're always smaller. So there's always two centrist parties, really, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, that actually came out of the Civil War, and people kind of voted along tribal lines for these parties. But I think it actually helped how quickly they were able to transform things, that you just had this giant kind of centrist progressive bloc. Because very rapidly they all adopted the same ideas. It was the ideas of the media class, the state class, which traditionally was always very concentrated in, you know, wealthier upper middle class areas of Dublin. So although the country was very conservative, Catholic, nationalist in its orientation, there has always been a heavy concentration of, you know, opinion-making institutions, university media, in a group of people that were much more cosmopolitan and that were always a bit hostile, if not scared, of that sort of thing. You know, the IRA romance and the kind of backward nationalism and Catholicism. There were
the violence that basically founded your country and got you independence and got you Ireland.
Yeah.
They were scared of that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a former Taoiseach, equivalent Prime Minister of the country, John Bruton, who's with the Fine Gael party, you know, he came out since his Prime Ministership and has written articles about how 1916 was unjustified. You know, the violence was a terrible thing. It could have all been done through the Home Rule movement. So I think that's a pretty common trend among Ireland's elites. You know, even they had the commemorations. It was interesting.
I didn't know that. That's appalling, because when I was in Dublin in 2015, there was a march because it was the celebration of the birth date of, I don't know, some great Irish nationalist figure who was in America or something, you know. And there was a march for people. And of course, you know, these are your founding fathers, and these people seriously suffered. And in some cases, in Griffiths, all these kind of people, you know, they were imprisoned and shot. And I think De Valera only just missed being shot.
Yeah, because he was born in the US.
Yeah. And there are others. For them to say that this shouldn't have happened, that this should have just been done through a home rule movement that had been happening since what, the 1870s?
Yeah,
it seems extraordinary.
Yeah, well, they had you know, we had the centenary commemorations quite recently. You know, 2016 to into the 2020s, and yeah, they were commemorating the 1916 rising. You know, they have like banners of the nationalist leaders over the GPO where this happened. But yeah, they were excluding a lot of the people involved in 1916, and they prefer to, you know, they'll highlight people like Daniel O'Connell, the great liberator, this guy who liberated the Catholics. He did a true parliament, he did a true peaceful means. So there's always been a bit of a uncomfortableness with the violent streak. I mean, for a long time, Patrick Pearse was not really a figure that was talked about much in the mainstream because, of course, during the Troubles, you know, people were deeply scared by what was happening in the North. And it was common for Republicans to invoke phrases from Pearse like "Ireland unfree, will never be at peace." And so there was kind of a move to, you know, focus more on the moderate, the parliamentary figures. I think that's really, I've read some figures from the time, like Desmond Fennell. He was a guy that kind of saw what was coming down the pipe. John Waters was a bit like that as well. But that was a big part of his diagnosis, as he said, you know, the kind of trauma of watching, you know, the bombings and the killings every night in the North and feeling like, again, you have a more liberal, you know, a more cosmopolitan state class that considered themselves more European, that this was just such a blight on the country. This was such a source of shame that this was happening in Ireland of all places. And it really caused a kind of intellectual reaction against nationalism. Like someone like Conor Cruise O'Brien, I don't know if you know him.
No. Yeah.
He was a prominent Labour Party politician, worked for the UN. He was an academic scholar. He wrote about Edmund Burke a lot. And he passed censorship laws on the IRA. You know, you may remember this. if you had someone like Jerry Adams speak on TV, they would have to have a voice actor.
Yeah. It was like that. They say in Today's the Day, and they say that they interview the Jerry Adams character. They say, and under government broadcasting restrictions, he must inhale helium before he speaks to subtract credibility from his statements.
Yeah, I mean, it was a ridiculous thought, because of course they're still being interviewed on TV, which you just can't know what their voice sounds like. You know, so. But that was Conor Cruz O'Brien, and he's another one that was just totally hostile to nationalism, as he would call it, any romance around the blood or soil. So this has been a trend for a long time with Irish intellectuals.
But it happened so quickly, though, I think. I mean, the Ireland of 2002, when I was there, essentially a completely different country from the Ireland of 2015. I couldn't believe it when I was by the Nelson's Column that you blew up, you know. Well, the IRA blew up. And everybody there was Nigerian. I mean, why is it so quick? Is it a change in generation? Is it for the fact that you either was very poor, even in the 60s and 70s? People were very poor. You know, they'd be sent to school without socks or whatever. And this has changed. What was the? Was it the abuse in the Catholic Church? Was that the turning point?
No. Well, I mean the reason there's no restrictions as such put on it is just because of the kind of left liberal consensus people have about, you know, humanity being interchangeable and, you know, universal human rights. But I think the reason the volume is so high is more down to economics, and that Ireland has embraced this, you know, very kind of open, fluid, globalized economy. And a big part of this new model is free immigration. I mean, it's, if you look at the countries that have the highest amount of inward migration since COVID, and it's, you know, it's UK, Ireland and Canada, and they all very much lean on this kind of social liberal market model. You know, for a long time, the strategy of the government to grow the economy is basically, you know, make Ireland as open and attractive as possible for global finance capital, international investment. And, you know, we kind of pick up the scraps based off that. But, you know, a part of that model is that you have a very open immigration system, makes it very easy for employers to kind of do what they want and quickly fill any kind of shortages, even in low-paid work. And that was the same model that Blair brought in. You know, Blair switched to embracing like a very kind of globalized neoliberal economic system. And a part of that was having a very open immigration system.
Yeah, I don't feel that living standards have particularly risen since 1997. I don't see it when this started. I don't understand. Do you understand? What is that? I can't see any logic in it other than the kind of fanaticism, other than the kind of underlying desire to just destroy your own country. Because it doesn't raise living standards. And if you're saying, oh, the NHS would collapse if we didn't have immigration. Well, it's insane. Why don't we train enough doctors and nurses, though?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the UK and Ireland both have a similar economic and political model now, which is, I'm writing an article about the kind of collapse of the traditional left since the 90s, like the social democratic left. Because, you know, there's a collection of things the left traditionally stood for, which basically like was reverence for the welfare state that you got after the Second World War. You know, in Britain, it's the NHS and everything you have from Beveridge, your board. And in some Scandinavian countries, they have this a kind of corporatist model that's really, it's like built on a spirit of self-sacrifice. But, you know, the left will kind of revere that stuff. But there's been a sea change since the 90s, especially. And I think Blair led this, but Blair's intellectual mentor was a British sociologist called Anthony Giddens. I don't know if you're familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he used to lead the London School of Economics. But it's been quite interesting. I've been reading back his works from the 90s. And he did see a lot of what was coming. You know, he was quite prescient in that he was a social democrat. He was a leftist. But he's saying, you know, a lot of this is becoming unviable just due to the nature of globalization, just due to the nature of free trade, you know, advances moving to a service economy rather than an industrial economy. And his project and Blair's project was like, how do you rescue leftist social democracy, especially the social elements? Like, how do we rescue leftist social engineering, maintain leftist government, and kind of make peace with what's happened since Reagan and Thatcher, not go back to the bad old days of, you know, because it did end in disaster in the UK, like the kind of central planning, the extreme like Keynesianism of bureaucrats that were running all of these industries and trying to control, you know, price controls and all this kind of thing. So there was a swing back to the right. But then when people like Blair and Clinton, you see them trying to kind of make peace with that. We're saying, okay, we can actually embrace American model. We can embrace these ideas of like competitiveness, post-industrial economy, and we can kind of, you know, piecemeal socially engineer society using civic institutions. Like you combine the state with NGOs, you have all of these public-private partnerships. You know, like even David Cameron's like big society model is all about this. Like we're not going to do anything with the government, but we're going to, you know, direct NGOs and charities and try and have some coordination on that level. And I think that's the model Ireland and the UK have had since the 90s, basically. But as far as the economics of it are, it's like you grow your economy by being competitive, which is, you know, you low taxes, cut costs, try and keep wages low, try and attract foreign investment. But there's a huge loss of sovereignty within that, you know, like the left was traditionally, you know, at least after the Second World War, there's an element of patriotism there. But none of this is really tied to the nation state there, you know, because it's given so much power to international finance capital. That you couldn't go back to that older model of kind of statist nation state social democracy. You know, for one, the industrial working class is gone. Got the service economy. We've got this precariat, they call it, you know, the people that work for Deliveroo and Uber Eats. Two, just the big spurt of growth that was there after the Second World War for decades is gone. And three, you know, the capital markets have so much power over individual nation states there in terms of that every nation needs to borrow and so on that, like, you can imagine, like, Jeremy Corbyn was basically a traditional British social democrat. You know, he wants, like, let's go back to Clement Attlee, let's go back to the spirit of 1945. Ken Loach made a film with that title about, like, the post-war leftism that dominated Britain. But you can imagine, I mean, if he took power, right, and he tried to, we're going to do away with austerity, we're going to go back to, you know, nationalized industries, we're going to grow our way out of this crisis, I mean, there just would have been a run on the pound. British borrowing would have become very expensive. They would have been forced to do more austerity. They wouldn't have been able to borrow on the capital markets. Stock market would have crashed. So it's like there just isn't much economic sovereignty for any country that's embraced that model anymore. You basically just have to outcompete the other countries with low taxes, with competitive arrangements for international capital. And then if you're a leftist politician, you hope that with what trickles down from that, you can, you know, have enough welfare programs to keep the masses happy.
Isn't it just the development to the supranational level of what there's always been at the national level, which is really a kind of a fake managed democracy? Almost, you essentially have an aristocratic system.
Are you ready for the future of the West?